It is Friday, April 12th. It is around 10:30 a.m. Not sure of the exact time right now. This is panel session number 4204, titled Mobilizing Social Activism. My name is Leanna Looney, and I am a first-year PhD student in the Department of Ethnic Studies at CU Boulder here. And I am with three amazing panelists today who will be dialoguing and answering questions about their social activism. Their names are Mr. Charlie Vanderhorst, Soraya Latif, and Sunming Jessica Pan. And they are joining us today. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Who's going first? Oh, I'm going
but
first.
Wait,
oh.
Not yet.
Okay.
Jessica Pan was born in California and spent her formative years in China and Taiwan. Before she moved back to the U.S. at the age of 12, she is a cell biologist by training and is currently a candidate for a Master in Public Health and Epidemiology with a certificate in Comparative Effectiveness Outcomes Research at the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. Her unique upbringing instilled in her passion to provide communities around the globe access to health care. For the past 3 years, she was the logistics coordinator for an NGO that implemented a malnutrition project in Cambodia and traveled to Kenya, Cambodia, and Puerto Rico to provide short-term medical relief. Pan is also a gun violence researcher, a journey she began at the University of California, San Francisco, in order to better understand why certain communities are disproportionately affected by gun violence. She is currently an intern on the Criminal Justice Policy and Enforcement Team at Every Town for Gun Safety, a nonprofit working to prevent gun violence and save lives. And she is the education presentation, development co-chair for SAFE. She is also engaged in these initiatives because she believes that health professionals and researchers have a moral duty, I agree, to disseminate their knowledge and educate the public on evidence-based policies and procedures. For Soraya, she is the program coordinator for public achievement, a project manager for PUCSTA, the leadership studies minor, and the communications coordinator in CU Engage. She has a bachelor's in international affairs and global environment affairs from CU Boulder. This past year, Soraya worked for AmeriCorps, National and Community Service, and the I Have a Dream Foundation of Boulder. She was born in Toronto, Canada, is from Trinidad and Tobago, and that's where she lived for 11 years. She's taught in Costa Rica and studied in Tanzania. She is passionate about learning from cultures beyond her own, about historically marginalized communities, and global citizenship. Soraya is a believer in storytelling, empathy, and that we all have the capacity for change making. And we have Mr. Charlie Vanderhorst. He requested that I not read the bio from the program, which is great. He really wants me to let you all know that he has been arrested twice for civil disobedience. Very honorable, honestly. This is an activism panel, so yes. He helped end the death penalty in North Carolina, and there hasn't been mass incarcerated execution mm-hmm. since 2006 in North Carolina. He also works with Reverend Barber for the Poor People's Campaign. All right. So we will start with Charlie here. And then we'll have a Q&A at the end, and I'll let you all know how to submit your questions after we have our opening statements. Just as a reminder, you have about 5 minutes for your opening statement, and then we will open the table up for some dialogue. All right, Charlie, and then we'll have Jessica, and then Soraya.
So it's great to be here with these wonderful panelists. I could talk about this for hours, as many of you know, but social activism was in my blood. My mother was a Holocaust survivor, and when my parents emigrated to the United States in 1952, Jim Crow was widespread, and the McCarthy era was going on, and my parents, who had survived World War II, were appalled, and they immediately joined the NAACP and the ACLU, and I remember as a middle schooler at age 11, how old was it? So it was 64 when the Edmund Pettus Bridge march, there were other marches around the country, and I was marching with my father in my little small town for Civil Rights Act, in support of the Civil Rights Act and then the Voting Rights Act. So it came in the blood, and it kept on going through my life. I mentioned the death penalty. That was an example of how one person can have an incredible effect. I didn't intend to it be. A friend called me up and said, what do you think about doctors participating in nurses participating in executions? I said, well, it doesn't seem very good. He said, well, will you write a letter to the medical board and to say you don't think it's good? So I wrote a letter in April of 2006 and didn't hear a word. All of a sudden, July 3rd, the day before July 4th, I get a call from the board. We're having a hearing. You wrote a letter. There was one other letter. You need to come testify. So I said, shit, I don't know anything about executions. And, you know, I wasn't really against them. I just thought that doctors and nurses shouldn't participate in them. But then all of a sudden I started reading about it, and they're awful. I mean, they cost more than incarceration. If you are black for the same crime, you're dead, as opposed to white people getting. And we know there's very good evidence now that innocent people have been executed. So the most notable thing was a young father whose family burned up in Texas, and so he lost a wife and his kids, and they had this, you know, bogus forensic fire person who looked at the burn pattern and said, oh, he clearly set the fire. And they convicted the guy on that bogus evidence and executed him. This was in Texas. So terrible. So I testified that, and then they said, well, what about if they're in there just to certify the death? And I said, no, because I had read that the physicians get drawn in because, you know, if you have an ex-addict, they don't have veins to put in the chemicals to kill them. So then they're doing surgical cutdowns. They go in to certify the death. The person's not dead. Then what the hell is the doctor supposed to do? Resuscitate him so that they can then be executed? You know, so no. I said they can't be in. So the board said, okay, can't be in. The full board then passed it, and that was it. Then the legislature passed a law, which I call Charlie's Law, because they said no one can reveal the name of a physician participating in executions, and doctors and nurses in the prison system aren't regulated by the North Carolina Medical Board anymore. But even so, we haven't had an execution since 2006. So that was one letter started, and one, you know, half-hour testimony. That's all it took to do that. So why should we take, and as a physician working with poor people, you can't take care of a poor person and not become a social activist. I don't understand how people cannot do it, because they're struggling. I have patients who are 26. They're working in a fast food place. They're paying my Medicare, right, because they have Medicare tax. But they themselves in North Carolina, because we didn't expand Medicaid, they don't have health insurance. It's fucking nuts. And so as a physician, if you open your eyes, and as a society, if you open your eyes, don't step over the homeless person. You go to San Francisco, you go on a nice trip and things like that, and you think, what the hell, in 2019, this wealthy city with, you know, Google and all the other stuff, why the hell can't they do something about the homeless there? It's ridiculous. Teenagers sleeping in doorways, you know, so it's just nuts. So what you need to do is you got to become educated, right? You got to read the newspapers, subscribe, don't get free news. The newspapers are going out of business. Visit agencies who work on it, this stuff, so you can learn what their issues are. And then you need United We Stand. It's very clear why in North Carolina we've had success is that you need allies. My issue is Medicaid expansion. But if I just focused on that and ignored environmental issues, minimum wage, all those other things that are going on in society, I'll lose. But if we all join together, and there are 200 groups in North Carolina who join together, you can achieve something. People listen. When you get together, you got to agree on common issues and put aside the ones you don't agree on. And the big thing that's going to happen with the Democratic Party, they're going to get in a circle and they're going to shoot themselves over the next year and a half. So, you know, because you're seeing it now with people criticizing and saying stupid things, not thinking through. So don't deal with the divisive things. Use social media to stay in touch, stay on messages, avoid distractions, and subsume your ego to the leadership. In North Carolina, it's Reverend Barber. We do that. All these other groups, they're not Black Baptists. There are other groups with other issues, but Reverend Barber, we're all members of the NAACP, and he calls the shots and we listen. Donate money, register voters, protest, and if necessary, civil disobedience. And fund the legal challenges. In North Carolina, we've had unbelievable success blocking our legislature. Every bill from gerrymandering, voting rights, the courts throw it out. Well, that costs money. So, and we don't, little store shop lawyers get together. They find community people who are willing to be parties to the lawsuit. So the big thing I worry about, particularly with the young people, we've seen unbelievable passion, the Parkland students who really did took with it and ran with it and are great. Now with the green movement of students in Europe and now spreading to the United States, you're getting 13-year-olds who are sounding smarter than most of our people in Washington. The question is, will you have the staying power? And I want you to think of... I'm probably going to cry now. Think of those Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, who were murdered in Mississippi over voting rights. So these are three college kids, two Jews and an African American. They were murdered. Think of that young mother who was murdered in Mississippi for driving people for that. Those people put their lives on the line. So for me to ask you, or for you to bitch and say, well, you know, I've got to do this or not, that is just wrong. So think of those people, what they gave of their lives to get to where we are now. And remember, 60 years ago, women were in the kitchen, African Americans were in the back of the bus, and gay and lesbians were in the closet. That was a lot of work to get to where we are now. So we just have to go this last step. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. There was a lot there to break down, which we'll get into later. Jessica, would you like to give your opening statement?
Sure. I don't know how I'm going to top that. I will keep it short, I guess. I will just kind of talk about how I got involved into the gun violence movement, and I will end with a quote, because I think what happens a lot of times, I love that you gave all the kind of to-dos, but something I try to focus on is this like emotional aspect of it, and how do we really connect with people that are in the movement on an emotional level so that they are really engaged with our work and also can connect to it on another level. So I got involved with gun violence. I was a gun violence researcher at UC Davis in the emergency room, and on my first shift in the emergency room, a gunshot wound patient came in, and I watched him get rolled down the corridor. And I was standing in the recess room as the physicians were trying to save his life and locked eyes with him. And he was yelling the whole time, saying that he got shot, and we knew he got shot. And I felt really helpless at that moment. I didn't know. Like, it was my first time, I think, really getting exposed to it firsthand in this kind of setting. So I learned about it. I became a gun violence researcher, and then I understood this huge health disparity that it affects certain communities and certain neighborhoods more. So when that happens, I think we really need to question, like, what are the institutional structures that we're creating that is perpetrating this, and what are ways in which we can understand it from a science standpoint? So when I look at gun violence, I see it from my epidemiology lens, which means that it follows this the epidemiological triad. There's an agent, there's a vector, and then there's also the environment. So it's not always about gun control. It's not. There are other ways in this political climate for us to also look at the other avenues and also understand gun violence as a disease that is spreading. So it's not the individual, but rather this social phenomenon that happens, and how can we how can we create it, how can we look at it as a disease and find ways from medicine and science to combat this problem? So that's how I got involved into gun violence and kind of my viewpoint on gun violence. And the quote I decided to share today, it goes, "Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now, love mercy now, walk humbly now. You're not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it."
Who's quote is that?
Sorry?
Whose quote is that?
Talmud.
Oh, the Talmud. That's Jewish.
Thanks, Jessica. Soraya, your opening remarks, please.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Soraya Latif, and I actually work here at the university for the Center for Community-Based Research and Learning. And I'm really inspired by both of the stories that you all shared, because kind of like our point of entry when working with our students, I'm a youth organizer primarily. I wear a few hats at the university, but we have a course here called Renewing Democracy in Communities and Schools. And we have 100 undergraduate students that work to collaborate with 250 middle school and high school students in Lafayette and Boulder. And we call them coaches and not teachers, or collaborators and co-conspirators, because the undergraduate students are learning a curriculum based in organizing and looking at the legacy of movements and learning pedagogies and tools to implement on helping young people access change. So the young students, the middle school and high school students, we come into the year beginning with asking them, can you tell me your story? And can you tell me what your experiences are as an 11-year-old, as a 13-year-old, how your identity and who you are and what your culture is and who your parents are has shaped how you see the world and what you care about? Because in order for you to take action on an issue that is going to be sustained action, that's going to be something that you keep with and you don't burn out from doing, that's just not just posting on social media and as an activity, but actually a sustained action, you have to find your stake in it. So we cultivate that self-interest and that idea of also validating their experiences as young people, right, and bringing their experiences already to the table. And we have them collaborate with the university students, and over the course of the year, they produce an action project around a specific issue in the community. So this year alone, we have 25 different student teams working on 14 different issues, ranging from one most recent next week. We have a student group who wanted to advocate for the city of Lafayette in Colorado to become a sanctuary city, and they met with someone from city council last week and found out that actually, in place, structurally, Lafayette has a lot of things that make it to be a sanctuary city, they just don't have the title. And the students were going to cancel their project. It's like, oh my gosh, like we missed this. And I said, no, because the premise of your project, the fact that you didn't know, probably means that a lot of community members might not know either. So they're still holding their walkout, they're still holding their rally, and they're going to have the chief of police and the mayor and different members of city council come and educate members on the community of the gap in that knowledge. If we don't have the title of sanctuary city, do the people in our city still feel safe and know that those structures are in place? So that's one example of the projects that our students are doing. And as far as my background goes, I was a student here at this on this campus up until 2 years ago. And like Liana said, I did this work through AmeriCorps last year. And I moved here to the States when I was 10 years old. And I grew up in the Caribbean, in Trinidad and Tobago, in a West Indian culture. And I experienced a lot of things as a young person in middle school, high school, that I didn't have the language for, like the multitude of my microaggressions, not really understanding like what people meant when they were asking for my specific race. And you feel this like internalized naivety because you're like, I don't know the answer to these questions. And through this work, you know, when you find, you discover things as you teach it. I've learned a lot about myself and my experience here. And I went to a high school in South Florida and was part of the IB program, and it was 79% minority high school. And we had 57% black students. And you come to this campus and we have 71% white students. And I still didn't know how to place these changes that I was experiencing. And we work predominantly with students of color in our program. So that's a little bit about what I'm doing right now. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you all. So thank you.
Thank you all for sharing your opening remarks. And before we get into the nitty-gritty, I was I have to tell you all about the Q&A session, right? So that you can start developing your questions now during our panelist dialogue. In this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers who are sitting in the back. You must write legibly, please. Write legibly. If you are a student or attending remotely, please note this in your question so that we can make sure that students' questions are our priority and make your questions brief and to the point. All right. At this moment, I'd like to open the table for the panelists to have a quick dialogue with one another. I can ask you all a question, or you can talk and speak with one another. If you all have questions for one another, that's okay too.
Just a comment. I love both of the perspectives, because I do agree, Jessica, that it is we forget that doing the research is important. I mean, even things like on the gerrymander thing, you can't just say, oh, we're against gerrymandering. You got to study what's going on. And, you know, brilliant mathematicians now have come up with a formula to show what extreme gerrymandering on. These were not, you know, social activists. They were scientists, mathematicians. And so similarly with gun violence, we can't assume something, you know, where you got to study it and you know, and learn about it, and then you introduce your social activism into it. So I learned, all medical students now, not when I was in medical school, but medical students now, they know about the social determinants of health. They know that you can't just focus on lungs and livers. Where do they live? You know, the reason so many African American city kids are dying of asthma is because of the living conditions, you know. So it's just like it was 100 years ago with ventilation and tuberculosis. So things like that, you got to study these things, and then that can inform your social activism. And I love that you're teaching both the middle and high school students and the college students. That's really brilliant.
Absolutely. I have a question for you all. It's 2019, and the world just seems to be full of social media activists, which is a great thing, right? That's how a lot of people are introduced to these issues in the world, right? And introduced to the stories of marginalized people. However, how do we mobilize social media activists? So how do we get people to be involved in grassroots organizations? How do we get people to be involved in the research that would then inform certain struggles?
I'll let you two talk about that.
I can speak a little bit, too. I think there's, like, first and foremost, like, when people are in the movements, it's easy to get really frustrated with just, like, the activity you see on social media, because that's such an easy access point for so many of us. But I look at, like, the Black Lives Matter movement from 2013, and every time there is a wrongful death of a black person now, that hashtag spikes, right? And it draws attention to the message of that movement. And the Me Too movement, that makes this now an open, like, community where if I'm a survivor, all I have to do is put that hashtag online and I'm no longer isolated, I move to solidarity. So I see those, like, very beneficial aspects of social media being this kind of, like, inevitable digital space that we have now. And I think, the negative aspect of it is that it's really easy to be an ally on social media. And it's often easy to do that because you don't have to take the action because it might not be impacting you. And there's so many things you can retweet and screenshot and share. But what do you do beyond that? Like, what do you do when you show up to the march and you don't know why you're there, and what are you doing the next day, right? So I think even with, from our perspective, when we are doing the work and we are sharing things, we can even be more intentional about how we're curating that sharing, because often, like I've been told before, like, oh, you seem a little angry at the world. And And it's about turning that anger into something that is actionable, right? So what are you sharing out as well for people to see? And this is their first access point into a movement or an idea or an injustice through your story on Instagram. And how are you also, like, as the actor, putting a call to action attached to that and having the whole message and the whole story involved in what you're sharing?
Absolutely.
And for people who are only sharing and, like, kind of accessing activism that way, not to, as part of, like, the arena, shut them down or cut them out, but invite them to say more and maybe ask, okay, well, what do you mean by that? I saw you shared this on your story. What do you mean by that?
So I just want to add, you made me think of something. Mm-hmm. So I use Facebook and Instagram, Twitter for some reason I just can't get into, but... on Facebook, when I post, I try to make it educational because I do so much reading on the stuff that, and I realize with, as I see it being reshared and comments and things like that, that stuff that I know that I post on there, most people don't know. So when I explain about the gerrymandering and how the case won, who did it, who was the volunteers, who thing and how it worked, and I explain that, it does educate people. But the other thing is, and the reason we were successful in North Carolina, it wasn't social media. It was boots on the ground. We showed up, and we had this 10,000, 30,000 people. And remember, most people aren't getting news these days. The newspapers, the community newspapers, are for the most part, are gone. But when, WRAL-TV has a picture showing 30,000 people showing up, and we did it as I organized the white coats thing. So we wear our white coats visually. We all get together. That people in the middle... You know, you're not going to get the right. You're preaching to the choir on progressives. Mm-hmm. But the unwashed middle, they don't know about this stuff. Mm-hmm. They probably don't even know that we didn't expand Medicaid or that we're polluting, horribly in North Carolina and the fracking and offshore drilling and et cetera, et cetera. So when they pay attention because you end up on the night news and you're on the front page of the newspaper. So they pay attention. And then when Trump won in 2016, we elected a liberal governor. So Trump won in our state. We elected a liberal governor and a liberal Jewish attorney general and a black Supreme Court judge. Liberal as well. So, and that was because people were informed by our being boots on the ground. So that's really important, I think, to show up.
Mm-hmm. I guess I can speak a little bit about how we used social media in our movement. So after the Parkland shooting, a lot of medical schools and health professional schools came out with photos saying gun violence is a public health issue. And that was how I think it can be a catalyst for inspiration as well as the education and organization tools. So because our generation is really moving into these cyber communities, I think it is a great place to be able to organize, but then have that actual in-person part where you all come together and stand in solidarity and have that photo or do this event together. I think something interesting that I just want to share is Fortnite. There are some people who are using Fortnite as a way to educate the younger generation about all the environmental issues that are happening.
What's Fortnite?
Maybe someone can speak a little bit better. I'm not a gamer.
It's a
video game. It's, like, very hot right now. sorry. That's, like, the extent to what I know. I just know a lot of people are playing this game.
I think you can build alliances, and there are, like, missions that you go on, and the characters have some really cool dance moves, apparently. And...
N-I-T-E, yeah.
But yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think other than, like, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, all of that, maybe the gaming community is this next population that we should tap into and mobilize, and also understanding what what are the issues that they're passionate about and that they want to see change, not just what we're passionate about.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, that's good, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you all.
How about questions from the audience?
Yeah, let's take some questions. We have one here from a Mountain Range high school student. Mm-hmm. Have any of you done any LGBTQ plus-based social activist projects? What are your views on the transgender hate coming from the older generation? And this could possibly be a good time to speak about transgenerational activism.
Mm.
So we have, I can just tell you our experience in North Carolina. So, you know, Reverend Barber is from a African-American Baptist church, and they aren't necessarily, that community hasn't been in the past, you know, all that supportive of immigrants' rights because they worried about jobs for African-Americans. They haven't been all that supportive of gay marriage or something like that. But Reverend Barber is a big tent guy. And so at every rally, we have LGBTQ folks speaking, including trans folks, up on the podium in front of those 50,000 people. We have Jews and atheists and immigrant rights, DACA folks. So it's important that we include all these groups together. And I just think that it's fine to focus on your issue, but I think it's really important to get together with everyone. You're a much stronger statement. And frankly, you know, as a physician, you know, I'm for Medicaid expansion and broader fixing the ACA and Medicare for all, hopefully eventually. But, you know, trans people are patients and gay people are patients, and so I got to be concerned about it. They may be poor, you know, so minimum wage is an issue, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think a lot of the, like, issues and structures are too interwoven to have, like, singular activism, right? Like, you have to be looking at it through this lens of there's going to be people I'm working with who have different experiences and identities than I do, or that I'm serving that come in with those different identities and experiences. And the intergenerational gap, like something we talk about directly with our students, is that you can't just be looking to your peers or looking even to us because we fall so closely to, like, your own generation. And we can't, like, make change or think about what we're going to do next without speaking to the movements and the people who were part of those movements from before us. And those, like, opinions are going to be different. And, like, while we're, you know, advocating for all of the, like, values that we're cultivating with you all, we have to be able to have this discourse with people who have different perspectives than us, because those won't change until they encounter it, right? Maybe that exposure hasn't happened, and it becomes really personal then when they're sitting across from a 12-year-old, like, student and having that conversation about their trans identity and their transition. We've actually only had one student group take up LGBTQIA+ as an issue, and they actually, like, came to us this year because they've been in the program now for 2 years and spoke to us about just feeling insecure about having a public project around the topic because they still didn't feel supported enough by the school and by their families and their own lives to make it now this public thing that they were going home and talking to their parents that they were doing at school about. So it is still this completely and entirely misunderstood. Like, the language is not even there yet for it, whereas for a lot of other issues, we have some of that language, right? Like, we have movements to look to, like, have, like, that help for helping students talk about it, but it is so personal.
So I haven't done any specific LGBTQIA+ work, but when we held a gun violence action week at the medical campus at Columbia, and we had an interprofessional lens and intersectional lens on it. So on our last day, the theme was moving into community. So we invited community organizations. And one of the community organizations we invited were a New York-based group called Gays Against Guns. And so we united all the groups across the medical campus that were about this issue and helped. It's all about bringing people together and then leveraging their platform, right? So we've created this week and we have this platform. Let's also leverage you where you can also talk about the intersectionality between gun violence and LGBTQIA+ issues. And and also how to work together. I guess I can speak for Columbia as an institution. It's very siloed. So that any time where you can bring these groups that are fighting for the same cause together in the same place, then you're unifying, and now your movement is that much stronger. You can build relationships. You can, yeah.
I mean, just to carry on for what you're saying, we know that there a much higher suicide rate among trans people, and we know that 50% of the deaths, particularly among men, is with guns. So there you got that intersectionality right there to make it a good to have these groups together.
And I think also we know that 60% actually of gun violence deaths are suicide. And then the rest is homicide, and then actually mass shootings is 0.2% gun deaths per year. So that is the intersectionality with mental health, right? And then also we have like urban violence, and then the education system. So it's always finding these crossroads in your work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Jessica, we have a couple of questions for you.
Oh, my gosh.
Sure.
We can take it as a team.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Well, thinking intersectionally, too, right, and along the lines of coalition building and solidarity, everyone should be able to answer the questions, right? All right. So we have another Mountain Range High School student asking what your thoughts are on increasing awareness on gun violence and whether its increase is parallel to the increase in school violence. Is the activism we are pursuing encouraging, quote-unquote, copycats? I think what they're asking is, by bringing awareness to this issue, is that then making gun violence persistent, or maybe even strengthening it?
It's a good question.
Yeah, it is a good question. As a public health practitioner, I feel like my lens on that is you always need to educate, but you need to educate with intent. And I don't know, I guess the research part of me is like, I need to go like do some research on this before I come back and answer this question. But I think my first thought is that there's always going to be trade-offs in the decisions that you make in life. And right now, I think people don't understand, like, gun violence. Since the Dickey Amendment, there hasn't been that much research. And if you survey a lot of the physicians, like, physicians don't know what to do. And so that's why we're building this curriculum for medical students and for practitioners to be able to have this conversation. So I think that education piece, at least for gun violence, isn't there yet. I think with young people, there's a way that you can do it so that it's not perpetuating violence. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, I guess you've started seeing after the mass shootings that the media is changing, because there is this sort of sensationalization going on. And I forget which one was it, but the police chief refused to give the name of the shooter. They knew who he or she was, but they didn't give it because they didn't want to give the platform. And I think that's a useful thing. It's sort of the corollary of protecting a woman who's been raped. Mm-hmm. As well, unless he or she or a man who's been raped come forward and want their name out there. I think there is that concern that's going on there. I think that the overwhelming thing, though, is research and education, and both of those things are important to educate people, and that if we didn't talk about it, I don't think these mass shootings would go away. We would still have loners who feel that this is the way they're going to, you know, go out.
Thank you. Let's see. Soraya spoke about reaching people who have different worldviews and trying to educate them in social media. How do we handle those who have been problematic but have apologized for their actions, especially in the age of cancel culture?
What's that?
I'm not sure.
It's like if someone does something, it's like public figure does something like problematic, then you cancel them. So like if a celebrity does something that you consider problematic, then you stop listening to their music, so they're canceled.
Like R. Kelly.
So asking like, how do we approach someone who says that they're sorry?
Yes.
Yeah, I think there's a lot, like, context obviously matters there. And if this is someone who is not, like, the R. Kelly or, you know, like, a major public figure who has done something that the reach is so strong and so wide, like, when it comes down to, like, a peer or someone who you're working or trying to work with and collaborate with, we always have to leave room for forgiveness. Otherwise, like, what are you arcing towards, right? I mentioned, like, the anger earlier, and we're not arcing towards staying angry at that person. We're trying to move forward. And if someone, like, there's always going to be someone with opposing viewpoints than you because of the experiences that they have had. So you're also meeting people where they're at, and, like, especially if they're young, in terms of the people that we work with, you don't know how to speak. You don't always have the language until you get there, until you encounter something. And there's so many times a day where, like, something is tweeted or said on social media and or just in person, and we don't know when something is bringing harm to the person we're sitting next to. And we don't know that because we have not sat in their shoes yet. We haven't said that thing to see the harm that it has brought until it's right in front of us. So I do believe in accepting apologies and saying sorry. And I say sorry every day because I'm still learning myself, right? Even though I'm in these spaces 24/7. And I think when it comes to the broader conversation that we're seeing with people who are especially of different generations, like Joe Biden, and not understanding, especially for when we're constantly having the conversations about how that is wrong and our movements today, when we immediately, like, I just had to see a post about that, and I can immediately internalize, okay, you know, no more of this figure, right? I'm not supporting this person anymore. But when do we accept the apology, and when do we acknowledge that maybe they don't always have the language to say sorry in the way that we're looking to hear it right away either, is another piece of that too. Yeah.
I agree with you. I guess I would add that there are, you know, people make mistakes. Biden is another generation, obviously, and people do make mistakes, and they generally feel bad, or they didn't know how to do it. I agree with everything you said. But there are evil people, too.
Absolutely.
Weinstein was a horrible person, and he needs to be in jail. R. Kelly is even worse, and he needs to be in jail. So I don't care if he apologizes or not. He needs to go to jail and be put away. And so I think there's you got to separate the people who are, you know,
redeemable,
right,
definitely,
from evil people.
Yeah, definitely. But I think, like, not letting that experience, because that's what we're all, like, talking about and buzzing around, are these bigger things where it's easy to say, okay, put that person, you know, that's not okay, and we all can agree around that. But when it comes down to, like, those interpersonal conversations that we're having with each other, I think it's important to not, like, use those experiences and then apply them to those as well. Like, we have to make space for people in order for them to make space for us as well. But I completely agree. Yeah.
And also considering the power dynamics between things,
absolutely,
too, right?
Right.
So Weinstein had way more power than your average bigot.
Right.
Right.
All right. So this is another high school student.
I love it that we're here.
This is great. Do you believe that the more subtle issues, such as microaggressions, pose threats at the same level as explicit hate? And how do you think that we as a society should overcome such issues that cannot be called out directly? And I would also add, in the era of color blindness and post-racialism. Mm.
What do you guys
go?
Racial bias training.
Implicit bias training, yeah.
Sorry, implicit bias training.
Yeah. No, well, both.
Yeah.
I mean, there are examples. You know, there's a famous example of the KKK guy and the African-American woman. They had a book together, and I think one of them passed away, and they did. And, I mean, he had outright hate, and they did come together, and they became fast friends, and they went on and wrote a book together and went on speaking. So I think even with the more overt stuff, you can get some reconciliation and education for people. You know, it's their upbringing and things like that. Mm-hmm. The microaggressions, actually, I think, can even be a bigger deal, though, because if you have this overt racism or anti-gay thing, you know what you're dealing with, right? It's a little easier to do, but the person who's being microaggressed, you know, the aggressee, it's hard to know what to do because, you know, are you going to be rude? Are you going to stop the conversation? You know, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I think you need to do it. You need to. It's hard. But I think the rest of us should give them, empower them to call someone out. You know, if it's a boss or a friend or et cetera, said, you know, mm-hmm. when you said that, that hurt me. Okay. When you say, "Oh, I'm articulate," you know, which is an old trope for people say for black people, "Oh, they're articulate," meaning they're, "Oh, you're not dumb like the other blacks," or something like that. So I think that you need to call people out on that because they'll never learn otherwise.
Yeah, and there's people who are in positions to be calling that out far easier than the people who are being microaggressed, and I think that's not to be undermined as well, right? And I think the microaggressions are incredibly powerful because often the people who are doing it might not think that there's any harm in doing them. It could be your best friend or, you know, your partner. And then when it's happening, we don't always know how to respond to them because a lot of the times it's easy to just brush it off your shoulder and say, "Oh, it's okay. You know, that's my friend, and they know better." But that builds up, and then there's this like an increasing weight on that person who's being microaggressed, and it informs how they're able to navigate the spaces that they're in. Mm-hmm. And then I think in terms of calling it out and calling it in, always recognize when you're in a position to do so for someone. And maybe the microaggression didn't impact you because it was about being undocumented and you have documentation status in this country. And we always tell our students there is a difference in being like an ally in those moments and an advocate, where maybe you're allying yourself in the moment and speaking out to it against the person who said the microaggression, or afterwards, like, you're making sure that you follow up with that person and letting them know that you saw it and that they're okay, are two like actionable things that you can do.
Mm. I think also for people who are maybe the perpetrator of microaggression is self-awareness and understanding your privilege, because if you are able to do that, then it's less likely that you'll really have like really offend people if you are always doing that self-reflection piece.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good question.
That is a really good question. Charlie, I know you gave us some tips on how to become an activist and how to be involved. And so I'd like you to speak a little bit more on that. We have a question. They ask, what is the best way to get involved or educated in different social activist projects? So you could read your list again, or?
Well, I guess the first thing I would do is, which I think Jessica brought in, what's your issue? You know, if you look at all the different things going on, what's your issue? Are you concerned about gerrymandering, environment, racism, LGBTQ issues, minimum wage? Mm-hmm. What grabs you? Is city planning? I mean, it could be anything. And homelessness, etc. So what's your issue? Then learn about it. You know, read about it. Newspapers, any research on it. What's the impact of, for instance, if homelessness is your issue, what's the impact of homelessness on a city? You know, why are people homeless? Well, you learn a lot of these people have severe mental illness, schizophrenia, major depression, etc., bipolar disease. And then go visit an agency that takes care of homeless people. And then, find out, talk to them. Talk, volunteer there and say, what are the issues that you're seeing? How could we end homelessness? And then go talk to a city planner and say, what are we doing in Boulder about the homelessness issue? And then, you know, all of a sudden, is there a nonprofit that's actually working with the homeless? And then you say, can I work with you? And what issues should we advocate for on behalf of the homeless? And then you approach let's talk to the mental health advocates, because obviously a huge bunch are that, and the housing advocates, and let's talk to another group that's dealing with housing, and a group that's dealing with disease among the homeless, because that's a huge issue, and emergency rooms, because homeless keep coming up because they get ill, and all of a sudden you've got a coalition. Okay, but you can't think, what can I do today? right? You got to think long term. You're not going to solve this issue by yourself. And you find allies, and you'll be surprised at how well. You know, just set aside a time. Don't give up your schoolwork, to do this, because you want. Remember, the best thing you can do. I always get things as a physician, from students who are applying to medical school and things like that. Say, the reason I want to become a doctor is to be a social activist. And I said, well, your patients, that's great, but they also want you to be a really good doctor. So be a good doctor because you're already an activist. You don't need to be taught how to be an activist. So be a good doctor, be a good student, get a skill set that's going to help, and work on the social activism on the side.
Thank you. All right. Another audience question. What should an activist's relationship be with the law? I think this is a great opportunity to share if you all have worked on any policies or reforms, to share your experiences with those.
Well, I've been in jail, so that's my relationship. My relationship with the law is being in jail. And I mean, I had to make a decision about whether I would go through, because I could have pled and then done some community service when I was first arrested in 2013. Because I wore the white coat and ended up on the front page of the newspaper, all of a sudden I was sort of catapulted to a leadership position with Reverend Barber, which was an unasked for thing. So then I said, well, gee, I can't just walk away, and pleading guilty would have been walking away. And so, and I was right to protest. The legislature were assholes. So I then decided to go on trial, but I also was a very busy professor of medicine and clinician. So I decided, I had to go to the courthouse in Raleigh, and let me tell you, it's a pain in the butt going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. It's not one day. And I decided I was going to go through with it. I talked with my attorney, a volunteer attorney. I said, as long as it generated good publicity for the movement, I would keep going. But if it sort of disappeared from the news, then it wasn't worth the pain and time that was inflicted on me. Every time, I wore my white coat in the courtroom every time I was there. And, there was pictures in the newspaper of me high-fiving Reverend Barber, walking into the courtroom and things like that. And every time I walked in that courtroom, I was on the front page of the paper. So that was good publicity because, it does a wonderful thing for affected communities when they see here's this white old man of power willing to go out and do that mm-hmm. thing. So, and it then generates other people, medical students and other doctors, nurses and public health people to get involved. So my position with the law is that I went through right to the bitter end with that. So I think it was important to do that.
I guess for me, I think it's a spectrum. Like, I think that's like the most you can get involved. But for me right now, it's really understanding all the different policies that are affecting your issue. So in the gun violence movement, there's been this push on the extreme risk protection order, and there's around 12 states, I think, that now has it. But it's as simple as understanding what ERPO is and educating people about it, or understanding the nuances that occur from state to state. Again, the siloedness, like things are really different from one state to another. And for me, so when we did Gun Violence Action Week, because we had this interprofessional lens, we had an actual law day where we invited lawyers to come speak to us. So it's finding people that are their expertise is there and understanding more about your issue within that sphere.
We work with a lot of undocumented and documented students, and what we often tell like our students here at CU Boulder as well, who might not fit into that identity, is that a lot of what we're doing is looking at policy and doing the research of what's in place to support and then might be working against the students that we're working with, and that what is legal is not often just, and what is just is might not often be legal. And what that relationship looks like without us always having, like, the core knowledge as well. So seeking out, like, people on this campus who are doing the work in different clinics who are in legal professions that we can get the information for, and having them come speak with our students and kind of bridging that gap between what we might not know but we need support on, and letting them know that this relationship is always going to exist when we're doing this type of, like, public organizing work.
Yeah, and I would also mention that the heroes of many of these movements are the lawyers and the law students. So those of you who didn't see, when in January 2017, when Trump took office and implemented the Muslim ban initially, there's this wonderful photos from San Francisco Airport, St. Louis Airport, JFK, of the lobbies of these outside the security thing of law students and lawyers, hundreds of them, with their laptops on the floor, helping people. And in Washington, the ACLU, again, working through the night to file briefs with the federal courts to stop it. And they won. And in North Carolina, as I told you, the lawyers. So those of you with money should give to those different groups that are supporting these and doing these cases.
And just hold on, because we're talking about education, since I did look up for Colorado, the Extreme Risk Protection Order is HB19-1177, if anyone wants to follow it. Or, you know, it was passed in the Colorado Senate state a few weeks ago. Thank you.
We have gotten this question twice. It reads, I'm a middle school student, and I want to learn some ways I can inform my peers on issues such as LGBTQIA plus rights. I'd also add any other rights. So what would you tell a middle schooler about educating their peers?
This has also been, in a way, said, but not as directly. Like, there is working things that we can do to talk to people who might not be exhibiting any passion or interest in the thing that you care about, and it's finding out what is that thing that they care about. So we often hear from our middle school students, you know, like, it's not cool to talk about this topic. Like, my friends are, like, leaving me behind at the lunch table, you know, and then they invite them to an event that we're having, and suddenly, like, they're in awe because they're like, oh, we are allowed to talk about these things, and it's not considered uncouth or uncool, right? And just because, like, I'm not seeing my friends talking about it doesn't mean that I can't access this conversation. And in terms of a topic that's, like, a lot more personal, like your sexuality, or like even like religion, we have a lot of, like, spirituality issues where they, like, friends don't feel like they could talk to friends about as well. And race, right? It's about, like, striking up the conversation of, hey, what are you interested in the very broad sense of the word. That's something that's accessible to everybody. Like, everyone has an interest, right? And from there, it's, well, what does your family care about? Where are you from? And we tell students, like, you're looking to have a conversation with your friends that brings together their core values, their experiences, and their identity and who they are. And then from there, they'll care about the conversation, right? And then you reciprocate it and you say, well, here's what I care about, right? And here's what I'm doing about that right now. And it gives them this pathway to, you know, everyone can access it, whether your friend cares about the environment, is extremely excited about composting, but has no idea how to talk about LGBTQ. But you do. So find that bridge and open that conversation with your friend and, like, figure out things that are going on, because there's always things that are going on, and maybe, like, your teachers at your school are not bringing that to you, or your parents aren't active at home. But, like, find that out. Like, we have all that available to us now on our phones, right? And just keep the conversation going. Like, don't be afraid to start that, because that's why. Like, you just see a lot of students who are just so afraid to speak to their peers, but they're very vocal when we go talk to them, right? They can't wait to share about what they did at the park and, like, how they cleaned it up and how they restored it, or the documentary they watched on coming out, and then they go home and they're not having those conversations, or they're not having it with their friends. So keep in mind, too, like, maybe you in this room who's not a middle school student, like, how can you be engaging that young generation, like every like kid who comes into your business or the kids in your neighborhood, and encouraging them to open themselves up to the conversations.
Very good.
All right, we'll take one more question. And this is a really good one to end on. What do we do when our voices... Oh, we have 10 minutes left.
Yeah, that I have on my phone. Yeah.
You're absolutely right. We'll take this question and then one more after. All right. What do we do when our voices are not heard or we cannot garner enough power or our projects don't work out? Tips for moving forward through failure, especially when working on such urgent issues.
Well, I would emphasize again that you can't do it by yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So you need to find others who agree with you. And that's what the good thing of social media is. So if someone clicks like on some statement on your issue, reach out to them. And particularly if they're in your community. And there are, you'd be surprised at how many people are quietly working behind the scenes on various issues that you are interested in. But you can't feel that you're by yourself. There are a lot of people working on these different issues, and you just don't know about them. You know, older folks aren't on social media as much. So you need to find allies, and you'll meet them, and then you can move forward. And then there are going to be failures. There's no question. We're in a dark time, you know, and it's a scary time. There are going to be failures, but, you know, eventually, as Martin Luther King said, you know, the arc of humanity bends towards justice. And so I do firmly believe that. So.
Yeah, I echo everything that Charlie said. I think that any type of change that you're doing is always going to be difficult. Like, the world is an extremely difficult place, but it is always becoming, is what we tell our students. Like, it is always changing towards, arcing towards this good, right? This better, like, version of itself, always. And it's not easy to feel like you're rubbing up against pushback, even in small spaces. And we experience that in just the schools that we work in the school district. We're working in spaces that are not our own. We're entering them as a partner, and a community partner that's coming in and trying to, you know, get these teachers and administrators to see the perspective of our students in these small little meeting spaces. And it doesn't always work. And they default to, well, this is the way that it's been. And we can't shift that, and we can't change that. And you have to keep coming back and keep finding ways to meet them where they're at and find that language that they're using and understand that, yes, they're showing up every day against their own walls and their own things that are pushing back against them in these school sites and these school districts that they're working in that we can hardly even tap into half the time because we're so focused on our movement and our work. And it's a continuous like relationship of like coming again and coming again and coming again until you have a relationship with those people and they're also advocating or at least like listening to your change, right? And again, like working on anything is extremely difficult, but taking the time to listen and learn from someone else is not. Like that's always available to us. So that's what I'd say, yeah.
Okay, I have three things. The first is actually I learn the most from my failures, so I love it when failures happen because when things are going right, I don't really learn from it, but when things go wrong, that's when I know what not to do again or how I can change. So I think that's the first perspective you need to have on failures when it happens. And actually for Gun Violence Week, for one of the days, we had this panel of all these esteemed researchers, and there was like four people in the crowd, and they spoke for 2 hours. And I guess that is kind of a failure of the attendance, and that's something I hope the next group will improve on. But I think a lot of times at least in our generation, we're so focused on the end product, and we want
the end product now, and we don't realize that sometimes the results come later. So something that has happened at Columbia is now that when there is a mass shooting or there is this really public shooting, there's like a statement from our administration that gets sent out to the student body that wasn't done before. And so when you are in this work, you have to pause and take time and kind of reflect on the things that are minuscule maybe to you, but is actual change that is happening. And my last one is, so after Gun Violence Action Week happened, there were like a slew of mass shootings, and then it just felt so overwhelming. And so I think when you do become an activist, you have to build actual barriers between you and the issue, and not realize that when something like this happened, it's an attack on your character or your work ethic, but we are, like, society is complex, there's so many forces, and that I know self-care gets thrown around a lot, but yeah, really finding those structures around you so that you don't burn out or have moral injury.
Those are good points, yeah.
One more question. The battle over climate change and gun reform have been going on for many years now. These affect the youth primarily who are a poor voting demographic, so they get ignored by legislatures. Mm-hmm. How do we crack the code to get the youth to participate in politics?
Yeah, I think that is a key thing. But there were more young people voting this last election in 2018. So I think you need to identify. You know, you start local. So is everyone in your family registered to vote? Are the 17-year-olds that are going to turn 18 aware that they can register? How do they register? Hand them the form. In North Carolina, I carry around a clipboard with voter registration forms. And I particularly like doing, because I'm a competitive athlete, so I like doing it in the locker room when they're naked. And I say to them, are you registered to vote? And they say, no. I said, okay, fill this out. And then remind them. And they're very good nonprofits now who will track those people. So you get them to register to vote, and then they will log them into the database, and they will hound them, you know, to hell to make sure they are voting on election day. So you're absolutely right. But again, as they said, find out what their issue is. Okay, so if they're interested in the environment, it's that, did you know that candidate X running for Congress is really for the Green New Deal, or if it's health insurance, or if it's LGBTQ issues, did you know that so-and-so is actually gay who's running for president? So these are things, how you educate them, and then you register them to vote. And you yourself, you don't even need to use an app. You can write down their names and get their email, and then bug them and say, okay, remember when you registered? The primary's tomorrow, and these are the candidates that are running, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely.
And have students before they're 18 get invested and speak to those, like their older siblings and their family members who are able to vote, because that is when, like, when you see a 10-year-old telling their 18-year-old brother or sister, like, hey, have you registered? And they're like, no. That's this moment of, oh my gosh, like, you know, here's my younger sibling now being way more informed than I am, because that's, they're able to do that, right? And it's that same, like, other piece of, if you are beyond that generation, maybe you are registered, like, speaking to people and saying, okay, what do you care about, and can we have that not be intersectional or no? Like, if you're caring about economic inequality, can you do that and be silenced about education inequity, right? Or can you care about education inequity and be silenced about environmental inequality? And, like, go take that to people as you're knocking. Go take that to students, because they can all access education. And also, like, the ability to be civically engaged is not always available to everyone. Like, that conversation's not happening in a lot of our schools. So paying more attention to that as well, because I think Charlie spoke to this in the beginning, but, like, if we have a student who's not getting access to certain things, then that shows us who we are. Like, that student who's at the very bottom shows us who we are. So these conversations aren't really happening for students to then come out of high school and then know, I should register to vote. And they also don't always know that change is not always progressive. So there's a lot of students who might be like, okay, voting's fine, but I don't need to do it because things will be okay. I think we got a big wake-up call in that in the most recent election, of course. But reminding them, you know, there's still change is still considered change to some people who want to shut down healthcare clinics for women and NGOs for women. Change is still considered change to some people who, you know, we had our first African-American identifying president in 2008, and we hear a lot of students say, why should I care? We already got that, right? But 5 years later, you see the hashtag and the movement Black Lives Matter. Objectively, does that look like progress or regress, right? So reminding young people, like, unless you get involved, it might not always be progressive. It might not be towards what you want.
And I just want to add, reach out to people who aren't in your circle, too. Mm-hmm. So suppose you know somebody's on the football team in, you know, in high school or basketball team. Do they know what the NCAA is doing to college basketball students, how they're getting injured, but they don't have any health insurance, they don't have any life insurance, they don't have any career in the future, and they're working as basically slaves for the colleges? So that might be their issue, which might not be as important to you, but it's a huge issue for these athletes. And so find the issue and then that they're interested in, and then hook them in. Okay.
Thank you all. Thank you. We are out of time.